Welcome, brave listeners, to another frightening tale, and the final one for season two. Please visit me at writingtales.com for more scary stories. And if you've written your own, please submit it for a future performance. Today's story, The Straw Doll, by Ryan DuPont. Come forward, demanded the old woman in a sickly voice. She sat upon the throne, her hunched and withered body lost inside the regal gown, and robes that long ago fit her snugly. A crown sat upon her head, heavy on her brow. Stand before me, granddaughter. Hear what I must say and do as I bid you. The young girl was trembling, but she walked forward, slowly at first, and stood before Queen Valda. Her hands were folded before her, and she bowed gracefully. She did not have the courage to look the queen in the eye. Vanessa, you are young and naive, she began, her voice full of gravel. She spoke slowly, often pausing to wheeze and catch her breath. Only 15 summers have passed since your birth. I'm sure you feel that I've taught you nothing and that you feel ill-prepared to rule. That does not matter. She coughed and cleared her throat before continuing. Right, Laria will pass to you when my body fails. The recent death of your parents has deemed it so. Young Vanessa wept. A queen does not cry, girl, snapped Valda. Sympathetic murmurs for the princess were whispered by the courtiers and nobles present. The queen was known for her cruelty. It was no secret to her that most of her subjects hated her. The kingdom would rejoice after her passing. Of that she was sure. She continued after casting a hateful glare at the members of her court. Now is not the time for wasted emotion, she gasped to catch her breath, clutching her hand to her chest. Your parents are gone. You are the future. Show no fear, else your enemies will strike you down. It is important that you obey my every word and heed my wisdom. I have ruled longer than any. She laughed, which quickly became a wheeze and a cough. Very soon, the kingdom will have a new ruler, a beautiful young girl with a whole lifetime ahead of her. For a while, there was silence in the room, but for the labored breathing of the queen. Her uncontrollable coughing racked her body violently. Unseen at this distance from her courtiers, a tear ran down her cheek. She was ready for the pain to end for her body and had lived too long. The joy of life was gone, and her golden years consisted of only misery and agony. Climb the stairs and stand at my side, girl, she ordered after she regained her breath. I have something for you. After the princess timidly climbed the stairs of the dais to stand beside the throne, the queen pulled a small straw doll from her robes and placed it across her lap, stroking its straw hair with her gnarled and broken fingernails. Vanessa reached for the doll on the queen's lap, and her hand was slapped violently and cruelly. The sharp sound echoed throughout the hall, and a whisper of discontent rose from the crowd. The queen glared at her subjects hiding in the shadows of the room, and she responded angrily, doing the best to raise her voice. Silence, you impotent dogs! If you are disturbed by my actions, then draw your daggers and come forth to slay me!
She paused, coughed, and waited for a response to her challenge. None came. In fact, the men and woman in the room slunk deeper into the shadows.
I thought as much from you, gutless, groveling swine.
Turning her attention back to her granddaughter, who was still rubbing the welt on her hand, she lowered her voice and began to speak.
This gift is not for your hands now, girl, but it will be soon. It shall remain on my lap until I pass. After you, and only you, shall take the doll. You shall hold it tight and let no harm befall it. Do you understand, girl?
The princess nodded, still too terrified to look her grandmother in the eyes.
Let me tell you a little story, she began softly. This doll has been passed down for generations in our family, from granddaughter to granddaughter for hundreds of years. Legend has it that the woman who created the doll and first gifted it to our family was a witch.
She gripped her robes with her left hand and the doll with her right, as she stiffened and waited for the pain to pass.
Silly, right?
The princess nodded in silence.
I do have a sort of love for you, Vanessa. I have become attached to you, more so with your mother, as I knew her longer. Oh, I do regret that she had to pass. The only thing that is important now is that you take care of the doll. It must remain in the family, or misfortune will be the result. It will give you the wisdom to rule. I know you will do well when my body is dead. I know you will be a great queen, just like me. Hold it close tonight and think of your mother. It will comfort.
The queen trailed off. She clutched her breast again and released a heavy breath. It would be her last. When enough time had passed and the people in the room were sure the queen was dead, the throne room erupted in relief and a celebration ensued. Before her handmaidens could shuffle her away from the dead queen, the princess reached out and snatched the straw doll from her grandmother's lap. The girl, because her eyes never left her feet, had not witnessed the eldritch wisp that escaped the queen's mouth with her last gasp of life. She was unaware that the near invisible swirling mist disappeared into the straw head of the ancient heirloom. She held the doll close as she was marched out of the room. Later, in Vanessa's bedchamber, servants tucked her into bed, kissed her cheeks, hugged her in celebration, and explained to her that tomorrow would be a bright new day for both her and the kingdom of Rylaria. She drifted off to sleep, hugging the little straw doll and dreaming of happier times. Sometime in the night, the ghostly green wisp slipped out of the doll and into the mouth of the sleeping princess. Valda opened her eyes. The first thing she was aware of was the crisp, clean air that filled her lungs and the lack of crippling pain that usually came with breathing. She bounded out of bed and looked at herself in the standing mirror. She took a deep breath again and smiled She twirled in the mirror and laughed with excitement as she reveled in her newly acquired youth and beauty. Sighing in relief that the transference had worked again, she threw open the shutters and gazed down upon the kingdom she would continue to rule. She vowed to herself that those groveling insects would rue the day they whispered ill of her. She could not wait to hear what all the good folk would say about the late queen. She returned to the mirror, giggling to herself, staring for a time in awe of her new being. The skipping from one life to the next was not always without regrets. She wondered what her granddaughter may have become one day, if allowed to live. But she tried not to dwell on it. She had grown quite fond of her daughter and regretted having to get rid of her. But she preferred to occupy the more youthful body of her granddaughter. It was easier convincing the young to hold tightly to the doll anyway. 15 was old enough to rule, and those who would take advantage, thinking her but a child, would quickly regret it. After all, she was 732 years old, and she had learned a thing or two about dealing with her enemies. Starting anew was always so exciting and fun. She stared into the mirror and smiled. With this young body, it would not be difficult to attract suitors. It would not be difficult to bear children, and perhaps if she lived long enough and started soon enough, she would pass the doll to a great-granddaughter this time, and life was good again. And she rushed off to begin her new day as the new queen. And now for another spooky bit of horror, this one written by A.G. Scott, called Pulling the Plug.
They had an old phrase back on Earth, starving artist. Before I left the surface, neither term applied to me remotely. Now, I sit here at the ship's bridge under flashlights, stewing in the knowledge that I'll starve to death before week's end. There's no preventing it, barring a miracle, and miracles are scarce. Especially when nobody knows you need one. I figure I might as well fill out the archetype. I've got a terrible eye for illustration and sculpture. So, that leaves the written word. Just as well, I've got a hell of a story to tell. Pulling the Plug by Jade Avery. It took me a few tries to pull myself out of stasis. My eyelids would slowly drift apart and I'd feel an itch surrounding the chip in the back of my neck. Then I'd look down at the tubes inserted at the crook of my elbow, which carried nutrients and anti-degeneration solutions. I'd pass out. My squeamishness nearly doomed me to a grounded life, but the crew of the scavenger ship Matador needed a pilot, and a pilot I was. Little else. It was a single red flash in the pod, and I expected an alarm to blare, but that never came to pass. It was curious that nobody prevented me from falling back into stasis. Emergencies excluded, one could assume that their sudden rise from torpor was initiated by another crew member at a scheduled interval. We rotated this way, splitting the longer voyages into digestible chunks. But the daytime interface in the wall of the pod showed that I was coming to my wits nearly 3 weeks past due. So where was Callahan? The man meant to take my place. Oh, my joints were stiff, my muscles struggling against an unseen force. To remove my oxygen mask and IVs on my own turned out to be the devil. I didn't watch the needles tugging on my skin as I yanked them free, but my imagination did the trick. It was a good thing I'd planned ahead for such a moment. I sank down to the bucket situated beneath me, scooped my long black hair into a bun and vomited spastically. And feeling empty, I emerged from my pod. The matador was carrying 13 when I argued my way aboard, making me the 14th. We'd lost only Murphy between then and the last transition period. I was first down, so 12 witnessed the initiation of my stasis. The next transition period had apparently come and gone. As such, one in my position would expect to find 8 occupied stasis pods and 3 wakeful watchers. I walked the whole ship. I rounded the ring of pods below deck, peeking into quarters and mess, and at last took the lift to the bridge, all the while counting heads. I got to 2, including myself. Callahan was sitting cross-legged in a corner of the bridge, thoughtfully circling his thumbs against the smooth brown jacket laid over his lap. He did not offer so much as a glance of acknowledgement. Apart from his thumbs, his body was incredibly still. I'd watched Callahan deftly perform a number of complicated surgeries. He had a similar intensity about him there in his corner. "Doc, why didn't you wake me?" My crackling, unpracticed voice echoed in the empty cabin. Callahan's tightening fists wrinkled the jacket. "There was nothing I could do. Miss Avery, nothing." There was another red flash, but again, no accompanying alarm. I dismissed this, believing it to be a malfunction of some kind. Callahan looked up at me as the red haze faded. His bloodshot eyes and sallow cheeks suggested illness of some kind. He had to be 20 or 30 kilos lighter than the last time I'd seen him. What happened? I pressed a red button on the comms panel. The interface lit up and spoke with an insultingly sultry feminine voice. "To cancel, release the button now. To send a simple distress signal, release and tap again. To encode a message, hold the button down until you hear a beep, then speak. When you are finished, press the button again to stop recording and send your signal." I held the button down until I heard a beep. I tried to sound authoritative and professional, but was undermined by a slight tremor. "This is Avery, navigator and acting captain of the Matador. We are in need of immediate rescue and quarantine. Lethal disease on board. Onset 2 weeks heretofore. 2 survivors, 1 in stasis. All confirmed cases are deceased and have been ejected. Faulty fuel cell necessitated grounding and repair at the trial colony on Gliese 667C. C. Repair deemed impossible. The Matador was forced to remain grounded during a search for parts for the fuel cell replacements. Facts indicate initial exposure occurred on the surface." Another lonely red flash, this one dulled by welling tears. "If you're hearing this, please, while our oxygen is plenty, many of our rations have been compromised. We will not survive the month." Callahan was checked out, and the direct comms proved useless. All I could do was send out a steady, weak distress call, and if I'm being honest, hope to expire before the rations did. I spent the next few weeks in solitude. I must have cleaned every surface 24 times, but my worry that the virus still lingered somewhere on board never faded. The rest of my waking hours were spent waiting by the comms board, praying for a sign that help was on the way. The good food, long gone, I resorted to the mealy emergency nutrition bricks. That is, until my body began to reject them. Soon enough, I'd lost 7 kilos, which was far too much for my short, wiry frame. Everyday tasks became difficult. I couldn't understand it. My arms were visibly thinner, but hung a great deal heavier. It often felt like I was struggling against restraints. All this was tough, but the worst was the never-ending itch surrounding the chip in the back of my neck. I remember fuming in the aftermath of another red flash, believing the itch was the reason I couldn't get any rest. Not true. The ship was quiet, I realize now, far too quiet for sleeping in. I sat in the mess, counting nutrition bricks, performing the grim calculation of how many days I had left to live. The intercom notified all hands, attention, in this case hands, just mine, to report to the bridge.
This is an emergency.
Finally, radar had picked up something. It was something enormous, and straight ahead according to the blinking indicator on the navigations panel. I looked starboard through the grand oval window. I wasn't expecting the rescue ship I'd hoped for, nor was it an asteroid or anything else covered by my training or experience. It was an enormous black square, a shape discernible only by the field of lights it occluded. It was an absence of stars. A flash of red light. The absence simply widened out into a rectangle, but having been in the business a while, I knew instinctively what this meant. The absence was a ship, and it had turned to bear its cannons. 2 brilliant white bolts came out of the absence like shooting stars, and before I could get the manual controls, the bolts collided with and scattered across the primary shield, rocking the ship on its axis. The Matador's shields were strong, but a couple more hits like that would drain the fuel cells and leave the main structure vulnerable. I'd undergone extensive training to remain calm in such situations, but I have to admit I was a little rattled. Then again, eh? Needles were worse. I took the Matador's controls in my hand, said a silent prayer, and charged head on, weaving through oncoming bolts. The closer I came to the absence, the more dramatic were the movements required of the Matador. A moment came when the bolts arrived too quickly to dodge, and another struck the shield. The lights on the bridge flickered, signaling the rapid draining of the fuel cell. Another hit would be fatal. I pushed the pitch control as far forward as I could, narrowly avoiding a bolt as the Matador cleared the bottom edge of the absence. Now gliding along its underside, I slowed down to scan for weaknesses. I saw none. 4 apertures opened above, making way for long, clawed steel cables snaking out of the black, like tentacles. Before I could re-accelerate, the Matador was in their grip. We were pulled into a blinding white opening and laid to rest in a sterile hangar. Figures cloaked in red emerged from a sliding door, carrying long black rifles. Unsure what to do, I ran to wake Callahan, but when I opened his pod, he was missing. There was another flash.
I turned around and a red cloaked figure was upon me. He lifted the butt of his gun and thrust it into my forehead. As I fell unconscious, there was a moment of relief. I've been so tired for so long.
I woke feeling a bit dizzy and weak in my quarters on the Matador. There was a deep red hue to everything, letting me know that the main power was off and the emergency protocol had kicked in. Indeed, I followed a foul smell to the engine and found that the fuel cell had shattered. The itch in the back of my neck was unbearable. "Don't play with your chip. That's been the drill since we were young, but I couldn't help it." I went to scratch my neck, but before my fingers could collide with something cold and solid, I felt around. It was a cylinder of some kind, maybe the size of my forearm. I plodded over to the mirror and looked at it sideways, but there was nothing there. I couldn't see it, but I could feel it. I yanked the cylinder away from my neck. In the doorway between seconds, I remembered the absence of stars, and suddenly I was no longer aboard the Matador. I was sitting in a cave, small enough that the flame of the lamp at the center of the room danced against every surface. I looked down at my limbs, all but one of which were entwined in slimy red tentacles. My free hand was hovering behind my neck, holding... I looked back, a tentacle dripping crimson. My blood? I looked around the room. 12 men and women in the same position, all of them prune-like from being drained. I fought my way free of the tentacles and crawled over to Callahan, removing the tentacle embedded in his neck, but it was too late. He was cold and blue. Emotions are useful in space travel. Fear keeps you safe. Guilt and shame keep you honest, and so on. At that moment, it wouldn't help anything. I reached up and double-tapped my chip, and the emotions subsided. And I knew what I needed to do. It was a sort of last resort. I sat back down against the black cave wall. I grabbed the squirming tentacle, and I set its suction cups back in place. After I had returned to the Matador and double-tapped my chip again, the emotions came rushing back. They were too much to handle. I had to get them out somehow. That's what I'm doing now. On the bridge under a flashlight. When I'm done, I'll go down to the stasis pods and rest a while. It's quiet here. Too quiet for sleeping. All I hear is the soft scratch of pen against parchment. There was another red flash just then. So quick, I almost missed it by blinking. That's how I hope to go.
You've been listening to Pulling the Plug by A.G. Scott. Oh, we've completed yet another season. Thank you, one and all, for joining me on these frightening tales. Some of them a little more cerebral than others, all of them dealing with something rather unnatural. Do tune in again in May for another frightening tale, if you're brave enough. Ha ha ha!